I want to share with you. I told you, I thought, you know, I get to share a lot of different settings, a lot of different venues. And but when I share with men, I just feel like in that one, I just like to kind of pull out the lessons that God, perhaps the most significant lessons that God has taught me as a man, as a father, a husband. And so that's what I've been doing. And tonight I want to share one. It's kind of, in one sense, it's kind of a fun one, but in the other way, it perhaps is one of the most pressing lessons that God has been impressing upon me. And I want you just to begin by imagining for a moment that God decided just to kind of really show off to us tonight. And while we're all gathered in here to have the service, what if all of a sudden the roof here just kind of parted and God just descended upon his throne, just right here in front of us. And then we're looking at God himself. He's made himself visible. He's on his throne. The angels, seraphim are around him. And we're like in the same room as we can see him. We see the reality of God. We're breathing the same air that God is breathing. If he was just right here by this screen and we were all looking at God himself, we're that close to him in just physical reality, what feelings, what emotions do you think you'd be having at that moment?
Terror.
Terror? Okay. Yeah, I mean, someone was asking me the other day about what will heaven be like, and they were asking, like, will we be, you know, keeping up with our families, and will we be kind of tracking down long-lost relatives and things? I said, well, you know, I suppose that'll all be happening, but I'm just telling you, I just have a sense when we actually see the God we've been talking about all of our life, everything else, all the other thoughts will just quickly fade into the background. All the stuff you thought you'd do, you probably won't do. You'll just be blown away by God. So terror, any other thought, any other feelings that you'd be having?
Awe.
Awe? Yeah, and you know, what about just a sense of holiness? Just kind of think that every sin, no matter how small, would suddenly be crying out like, I need to get out of here. This is God. He's holy. What about a sense of power? You know, you just have a sense that these walls could not contain the awesomeness of God, the power of the universe. Anything else? What about love? I mean, would you just feel overwhelmed by, he is love. And would you not just feel overwhelmed by a sense of just overwhelming love? You know, have you ever just thought about that, what you will be feeling when you're in the presence of God? Well, I want you to look at a couple of verses. I'm going to just share a couple of verses that a while ago, God took me on a little journey. And I want to share just a couple of verses with you, and then I just want to kind of talk to you about how to apply it. And this is a verse where the psalmist, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this verse, but the psalmist was trying to imagine what it would be like to be in the presence of God. What would you feel if you were right there in front of him? And so in Psalm 16, verse 11, he says this, "You will show me the path of life." Then he says this, "In your presence is fullness of what?
Joy.
Of joy." When you get right into the presence of God, what do you experience perfectly in complete fullness? Joy. Now, you know, when I read that, I thought, now I would expect him to say, in your presence is fullness of holiness, of purity, of love, perhaps. But he says, when you get right next to God, there's an overwhelming sense of joy. And in fact, I think what Jesus, when he kind of was touching on the same thing, you remember in John 15, he's talking about the vine and the branches, and he's talking about the branches abiding so closely in the vine that you're just as close as you could be, and that's what the Christian life's supposed to be about. You being as close to Christ as you can possibly get. And he explains that very beautifully and about bearing fruit and so on. And then he gets down to verse 11. He kind of wraps up that discussion and he says, now, why have I been telling you this? Why have I been talking about abiding in me? He says, for this reason, so that my joy could be in you and your joy could overflow. That's how he wraps it all up. He says, how do you know that you're abiding in Christ? Simple. His joy is in you. So this has become for me something of a spiritual thermometer. It's how I measure my Christian life. See, I used to think that the way you measured someone's Christian life was perhaps, you know, by how much scripture they knew, or how sinless they were, you know, or by how saintly their prayers were when the pastor asked them to pray during the service. And, you know, wow, that guy really is a spiritual guy. Listen to the King James that he weaves into his prayers when he's talking to God. You know, there's all kinds of ways. I actually thought that, you know, there was a time where if you were really a spiritual person, that all you thought about was the suffering of humanity, you know, and the countless number of souls that were lost at this point and not headed toward heaven. You know, I had a friend one time when I was in seminary. He just wanted to be as spiritual as he could be. I mean, he really did. His desire was, and it wasn't a prideful thing. He really wanted to be as spiritual, just the finest Christian he could be. So he's just so serious all the time. He'd go down and minister to drunkards down in town in the evenings, and he would just do all kinds of stuff. He's a great guy. But he thought to be really have a heart like God meant that everything was serious. I mean, how could you joke around when there's millions of people who've never heard about Christ, you know? How can you take an evening off and watch a ball game? Like, he'd go down and wait outside of bars and try to minister to people as they're coming out the door. And so as you can imagine, he was having trouble getting a date. and so my brother, one of my brothers decides to help him out. Because my brother was married. So he sets this guy up with a date, with a double date. And so they have this guy come over to their house along with this girl. And they're playing a game, What If? It's a great ice-breaking game, a great game to kind of get to know people. So my friend, his question is, if you could take a date anywhere in the universe, where would you take her? It's a great question. You know, this girl that's kind of been set up with him that night is curious to know. Well, he thinks for a moment, and I kid you not, this is his answer. It's a girl he'd never met before. It's a party. He's having a good time. He looks at them, and he says, I think I would take her to hell. Now, I tell you the truth. I think I would take her to hell because, you know, I think if you could see how awful hell is, it would change the way we live. We'd be better witnesses, you know. We'd serve more faithfully in the days that we have to keep people from going there. And so, needless to say, that was his last date with that girl. now that the girl knew where he wanted to take her, she wasn't interested. Like, no, don't go there. But have you known people like that? Like, it's everything so serious, you know. But what's the scripture saying here? How do you know someone that really gets the Christian life? I mean, they just nail the Christian life. They get a home run on being a Christian. What does it say there? When you're right next to God, you're filled with joy. And so here's another thing, though, because I know that. I know you're supposed to be joyful, but, you know, there's just so many things in my life that cause me not to be joyful. And so, you know, if it wasn't for all these things, I suppose I would be joyful. But there's another verse that's really interesting, too. It's John 16, verse 22. And Jesus he's getting ready to be crucified, so he tells his disciples, now I'm going to be leaving you, and for a while you'll be sad, but he says, then I'll be back, I'll be with you. And he basically says, and when I'm resurrected, when I return, he said this, he said, no one will take your joy from you. Nobody can take it away. Now, you know, that's a verse that you might question a little bit, because you'd say, well, maybe no one could take those 12 disciples' joy away, but there's some people who've taken my joy away. Those guys never had a boss like I've got. Those guys never had a teenage son like I've got. You know, they don't have a neighbor like I've got. I mean, there are times when I just cannot have joy when that person acts that way toward me. And so this is what happens with me. I'm going along in my day, and I'm, you know, in a pretty good mood. Things are going okay. And then someone cuts me off, almost sideswipes my car. You know, something happens that just really offends me. And all of a sudden I notice the joy is gone. The joy has disappeared. And I think to myself, well, you know, it was a hard day. I mean, you know, who could be joyful when these kind of things happen? But what these scriptures are saying is, that when you're in the presence of God, you'll be experiencing fullness of joy. So if all of a sudden you're not experiencing joy, what has happened? Did God go anywhere? No. You went somewhere. You are no longer abiding in the presence of God anymore. This is what I used to think. I used to think that when I had a quiet time in the morning, that I entered into God's presence, and I had this great time with God, you know, checking in. This is all wonderful, God, you're so awesome. Okay, but I got to go now, because I've got to get, you know, I've got lots to do. So I'll see you same time, same place tomorrow, and I go off into my day, and the world would beat me up and disappoint me and undercut me and lie about me and cheat me, and by the end of the day I'd come, you know, the next morning I'd come limping back into the presence of God, miserable and in a bad mood, and God would have to kind of patch me up, and then I'd, you know, I'd go back out into the day and get beat up again. But that's not how you abide in Christ, is it? When you abide in Christ, that doesn't mean having a quiet time. That means consciously throughout the day enjoying the presence of God. Whether you're in the office, whether you're at Walmart, whether you're driving down the freeway, wherever you are, enjoying God's presence in your life. And how can you tell if you're not in God's presence anymore? Because there's no joy. That ought to just be red lights flashing in your life. Okay, there's no joy, something's wrong, I'm not abiding in His presence anymore. By the way, the other thing is, if no one can take your joy away from you, then why do you lose it? Why do you lose it? Because you surrender it. Because in the book Unlimited God, I talk about the joy threshold, which is there comes a certain point in your life where you say, if I ever get treated like this, if I ever get hurt at this level, I just can't be joyful anymore, so I'm letting it go. And we all have that threshold. If I get pushed to that place, I can put up with a lot, but if someone does that to me, I'm just surrendering. I can't hold on to joy when that happens. And at some point, every one of us in the room has a threshold where if they hit that button, we just let go. It's like, I can't hold on to my joy anymore if that's going to happen. But the reality is, that what happens is we get our eyes off of Christ, we get our eyes off of God, and we leave His presence. We're not abiding, we're not walking closely with Him anymore. Someone hurt us, so now we're looking over at the person who hurt us. We're moving in that direction, we're moving out of the presence of God. So for me, what I want to just, the journey that God had me on was to say, Richard, why is it important to hold on to the joy of the Lord? Well, because really life is too brief and too hard to squander even one day of it joylessly. Life will pass quick enough. Why would you waste a day without joy? And you know what else I realize? My wife deserves to have a joyful husband. Life's hard enough as it is. At least she ought to count on the man of God in her home to be holding on to His joy. My kids deserve to grow up in a joyful home. And so that means that the dad of the home has got to hold on to the joy. But what I want to talk to you about for the next few moments is how hard it is to do that. And why some of the places in our life especially, they're just, I think for men there are certain buttons, and Bruce has touched on one that I'm going to go back and visit for a moment. Why is it that we choose to let go of our joy? Why would you want to be in that place? Well, it happens to all of us. And so I want to just talk to you about a couple of places in particular. And one of those places, I suppose the most heartbreaking place in a sense, for a lot of us as fathers at least, is when it happens in the home. Because I can tell you, when the dad, the husband, loses his joy, home's not necessarily a good place to be. I remember just so many times. So I'm a task-oriented person, very task-oriented. By the way, how many of you use Microsoft Outlook? Do any of you use Outlook? Okay, you know, it's a great organizer. I have to live by Outlook, and of course they've got that one, the task feature. Isn't that a cool feature? You can put all your tasks in there, and you put the date when it's due, and various details, and so on. And then off to the side there, what is that nifty little feature there, right on the side of each task? It's the checkbox, right? And now, if you're not task-oriented, you don't understand this. But for task-oriented people, you realize there is few things that give a greater rush than when you get to check that box, when the job is done. You know, that's the greatest part of finishing a task, is checking the box. Now, don't admit this if this is you, but have you ever, you know, maybe on a Saturday, you had some extra time, and you got something done, you know, fixed something around the house, you took care of something, and then you realized to your horror that you forgot to put that on your list of things to do. Like, now, don't admit this if you've done this, because you're sick if you do this. But have you ever gone back later and actually written it on the list? Like, I mean, it's already done. Like, you've already put all the tools away. You've swept the floor. There's nothing left to do. But you think, I just got to check that box. And so you write it on the list for no other reason than then to check the box. Like, oh, what a rush that was, you know, finish another task. Like, I mean, that's the kind of task-oriented person that I am. And so the problem is that my family can become a task to me. Being a good husband can become a task to me. And so when I was a pastor especially, you know, I was never good at taking vacations because I just always had too much to do. I'd work too hard. So, but I knew that I should spend some time with my kids. We should have some kind of vacation. Besides that, I'd have to preach a Father's Day sermon, and I'd have to have some illustration of me spending time with my kids. So we had to go somewhere on a vacation. So I remember one year, we're in Canada, we're going to drive to California, we're going to go to Disneyland. And so we're going to spend about 2 weeks in a minivan with three kids. And so I didn't normally even drive the minivan. I mean, I drove it on Sundays if we're going somewhere as a family. But normally I drove another car. My wife drove the minivan during the week, shuttling kids. So, but I just felt like if we're going to live in this minivan for 2 weeks, I mean, it should at least start out clean, should it not? And like, how many of you have the ritual of the day before clean up the minivan? So I get out there, and I mean, I haven't driven it for a while. In fact, I never sat. I mean, the entire time we went through our minivan years, I never sat in any other seat but the driver's seat. I don't think I ever sat in another seat. If I was in that minivan, I was driving it. I had no idea what atrocious, horrific things were happening just a few seats back. But I go back there, and I can't believe what I'm finding there. Those little pockets on the side you open up, I found a tuna sandwich inside one of those. Like, my kid was eating a sandwich, and he got to the end, and he thought, you know, I mean, I guess I could throw this in the garbage, but you know, who knows? I might need it again sometime. I'll just stick it here in this little nifty side pocket. And there are all the places where you have, like, the juice holders. Like, the juice and Coke and stuff would spill out, and it would fall down and make pools that would crystallize into a cement-like surface. I'd go through an entire bottle of industrial strength Armor All every time, just scrubbing and scraping. And there'd be all kinds of debris down at their feet. I mean, they never thought to pick stuff up before getting out of the van. So, I mean, I would have just bag loads of garbage and filth and disgusting things. The only time you ever used, you know, half of those attachments to a vacuum cleaner, you have no idea what they're for, but it's for times like that when you've got to get under every little crevice and crack and hard. I'd be bent over, contorted, trying to get down under those seats. I'd be giving myself hernias, trying to vacuum every corner, getting every little crumb. But by the time I was done, I mean, you could see your reflection in that dash. I mean, it was perfect. There wasn't a spot on it. Remember, that morning, we're getting ready to drive to Disneyland, and my kids are so excited. They were in the van an hour before departure time, just like, we're going to Disneyland. We're so excited. So, of course, they hadn't eaten breakfast or anything, and my wife actually missed her calling as a cruise ship entertainment director. Like, she just like, this party's central. Like, let's have a party. And so she's thinking, those poor kids are all sitting in the minivan. They never had breakfast. I mean, they got to eat something before we leave town. So she comes out with 12 pieces of toast. She's like, here, kids, here's some toast. All I can see is 2 million crumbs being ushered in to my perfectly crumb-free minivan. I actually flung myself against the sliding door and said, you can't bring those in here. I gave myself a hernia last night vacuuming up
last year's crumbs. I actually made all three kids get out of the minivan, stand in the driveway, and eat their toast. And then they had to go, they had to go through a crumb security check before they could get back into the car. My son Daniel required extra screening just to make sure he was not bringing a bunch of garbage in before I got out of the driveway, for pity's sake. And so, you know, you can imagine how much fun it was going on vacations with me. And we go to a theme park. And you know how expensive it is to take a family of five to Disneyland? It was incredible. I mean, when they told me the price, I said, I'm not trying to buy Disneyland. I simply want five people to spend a few hours in here. Like, what would that cost me? I mean, it's just incredible. So, of course, you're figuring out, okay, how is there any way I can get value out of it? Well, I can look myself in the mirror and say, that was worth how much I paid. Well, it's because you got to put as many hours in as possible. So, like, I don't enjoy theme parks. I conquer theme parks. And so I had gone online. Like, I figured out which rides had the longest wait times. You know, you go to some of those rides, like Indiana Jones ride, it's like 3-hour wait at the peak times. Like, I am far too busy of a person to spend 3 hours waiting for a 1-minute ride. So I said to my kids, we've got a plan. I've got it all scoped out. Like, we will get to every ride, see every show. We'll have to march fast though. So, you know, at about 6:30 that morning, the alarm's going off and I'm bellowing out, all right, everybody, let's go. We're burning daylight. Come on. The park will be filled with people before we get there. If you keep lollygagging your bed like that, come on, let's go. And so we'd be at the gate at least 45 minutes before it opened, and we're right at the front, so I'd have my map in front of me, and I'd have everything all planned out. I'd say, okay, kids, gather around. As soon as they open that gate, we're going about 50 yards straight ahead, then we're gonna go due west. I'm gonna keep a fast pace here. I said, no lollygag, no, I said, if you fall behind, I said, we'll just meet you at the front gate at the end of the day. I'm not gonna wait around for any slow pokes. And then my kids would say awkward things like, well, Dad, like, when are we gonna stop and go to the bathroom? I'd say, son, bathroom breaks are for the week. Do you understand? Well, we're wasting time in the bathroom. There's families lining up behind. I said, you see all these people passing you? You'll be standing in line behind them for 2 hours. Get used to seeing that t-shirt. You'll be staring at them for 2 hours in line. Pick up the pace, son. Well, Dad, when are we going to stop for lunch? See, son, that's our strategic advantage. While weaker families have to stop to eat and drink, we can be knocking off another major ride and seeing a show. Now, come on, pick up the pace. My sons, as they got older, it was getting a little awkward for them, but my daughter, my princess, boy, she was a keener. She'd just hold on to my arm, and she'd be flung like this, like, Dad, I'm with you. Don't leave me, Dad. And by the end of the day, I mean, we'd hit every ride, seen every show, done every exhibit. And we walked off and I could check the box. I came, I saw, I conquered Disneyland. You know, you are no more. And so you can imagine again, like the joy we had as a family. And within a few weeks, my family typically started speaking to me again and all was well till the next vacation. But you know, my wife, she began to talk to me about this. And she said, you know, life's not about the destination. Life's about the journey. And we're supposed to be making memories here. And my wife would just say, you know, Richard, a lot of times, can you imagine being at Disneyland and not having fun with your father? Like, there's Mickey Mouse, and you're having a miserable day. And my wife said, Richard, something's not right if at the end of the day, on vacation with you, they'd rather be somewhere else. I was checking the box. You know, I remember one time I was traveling a lot and I had to actually call my wife. I got a flight delay in Chicago O'Hare. I had to spend the night in a hotel there. Called my wife. I was feeling bad because, you know, here she is taking care of the kids while I'm away. And now she's got to take care of them another day till I get home. And so I called and said, Lisa, I feel so bad. You know, you've already taken care of the kids for several days without me. And now it looks like you'll be without me another day. And I'll never forget this. My wife, she wasn't trying to be cruel. She just said, well, Rich, it's okay. Don't feel so bad. She said, you know, in a lot of ways, it's just easier when you're not here anyway. She said, because when you walk in the door, the tension level just starts going up. You start barking out, well, why isn't that done? Why is there a mess in here? Who left this here? And she said, you know, everybody knows when Dad came home because the joy level goes down. It doesn't go up. And And I thought to myself, no, God, why does that happen to me? Like when I'm in your presence, there's fullness of joy. So how come even on a vacation, people could be around me and not being experiencing joy? You see, I don't know what happens to me, but there are moments in my life where I just, stuff irritates me like a messy minivan or like, you know, a few ruts in an otherwise perfectly manicured yard, and all of a sudden the joy is gone. And you think, is that all it takes? Like, is that all it takes? And I just freely surrender my joy? It's, okay, my joy's gone. I can't hold on to that anymore. I had to wait 10 extra minutes on a line at Disneyland. There goes my joy. You know, one of my kids has to stop and use the bathroom. We were making such good time. Okay, there goes the joy. What does it take for you to surrender your joy? What does it take? And that happens. That doesn't happen. Your joy's gone. You know, I've always been inspired by Paul and Silas, Acts chapter 16. You remember them? They're falsely accused by a bunch of exploitive men that were abusing a young girl. They're lied about. They're beaten up in downtown Main Street. Clothes ripped from their bodies. They're lashed 40 times, almost to the point of death. They're put in stocks down in the dungeon. And at midnight, at the darkest point of the whole day, what are they doing? They're singing hymns. They have the joy of the Lord. How could they do that? Well, you see, you could take away their pride. You could take away their clothes. You could take away their health. But you could never take away the presence of God from them. You can't remove somebody from the presence of God. And if your joy comes from the presence of God, nobody can take that away. You can lose your job, but you can't lose the presence of God. You can lose your savings. You can lose a car. But nobody can take the presence of God away from you. You have to walk away from that presence for you not to be experiencing anymore. And so I don't know where you are, but what was so bizarre to me is when I began to reflect on it, I thought, you know, if I was going through a terminal illness, okay, maybe I could lose my joy. But I would lose it on vacation. Like, I would lose it spending it with the people I love the most in my life. I'd be in a place where I should have been experiencing some of the most incredible joy I'd had all year, and I'd end up we'd be in a minivan where nobody was speaking to each other. I'd say, God, that can't be right. And I think I'm the cause of a lot of that. God, what would it take if suddenly my joy was so overflowing, like you said it should be in John 15:11? What would that do to my family? How would that impact my kids if Dad's joy was always overflowing? What would that do to my home life? Well, that was one thing. A second area, and again, these are areas that are just kind of crazy. Like you think, okay, like I understand if, like, you know, you get fired from your job. Okay, maybe your joy takes a hit or something. But there are certain things in your life where joy ought to just be automatic. I mean, that just be assumed you got joy in this, like going on vacation with your family. But, you know, another area for me was worship of all things. I mean, because what is worship? It's drawing into the presence of God, isn't it? So when you're in God's presence, shouldn't it be just an awesome experience? I mean, if you're ever going to have joy, it comes from being in the presence of God. So when you go to church, shouldn't that just be the most joyful thing you do in your whole life? But folks, is it possible to go to a church service but not encounter God? Could you attend a worship service and yet never draw near to Him? Yeah. I know lots of people who encounter a song service but never encounter God. They encounter a sermon, but they never encounter God. And I remember when I was running this seminary in Canada several years ago, I remember one week, it was just a brutal week for me. I spoke in three different states that week, three different time zones. I preached eight different sermons that week, and I probably heard another eight sermons, and so I am all sermoned up. And I fly two time zones back into my time zone. I get home at midnight. Luggage was delayed. I've got to go through customs. I have to drive 40 minutes back to my house. All my family's in bed. I'm exhausted. I climb into bed on Saturday night. And then I had this terrible thought. Tomorrow morning is Sunday. And my brother was the pastor. He was a good pastor. We had a good church. But I'm beat. And I'm thinking, I don't want to go to church tomorrow. I mean, I have nothing against church, but I've preached eight sermons this week. I've heard eight other sermons. So I've been in at least 16 different worship times this week already. I feel like I could sleep through tomorrow and My soul would be perfectly fine between me and God. But I've got a problem. I've got three teenage kids. And so I don't want my three teenage kids seeing Dad sleeping in on Sunday morning. So I got to go. You know, I just have to go. So I dragged myself out of bed. I'm going to church. It's kind of like eating oatmeal, you know. You do it because it's the right thing to do, you know. So I'm going to be in church because that's what you do. I mean, that's what people expect me to do. What would they think if I was in town and not in church? So I go. And the problem was that we had a worship pastor, and he had this one song that he liked to sing. It was just a terrible song. Like, the words were off. Like, not all the words were off, but at a certain part, it was just totally unbiblical. Like, it just irritated me that I should have to say words in church that were not true. Even if you're playing a guitar, still, you should not have to say them if they're not true. And so it just irritated me. The problem was that this song was our worship pastor's favorite song to sing. So we sang it every Sunday, and it just drove me crazy. And at times, what I would do is, well, I always try to participate. So I would, when we would sing the words, the lyrics I thought were okay, I would sing away, and that was fine. But then when we got to the part where I didn't think it was biblical, I would suddenly pretend that I had to cough. or I would act like I suddenly had just gotten a divine message. I had to hold on for a moment while God and I communed. And then whenever it got to the good words again, I would, you know, join back in. But this time, you know, I don't even want to be at church. I'm only there because I have to be, to set an example. And so, I'm not even at my seat yet. And the worship leader says, "All right, everybody, let's sing the song that Richard Blackaby can't stand." And so, all together now. And so, like, I'm just in such a bad mood already. That just puts me over the top. So I sit down and I decide, I'm just not going to sing. Now, I always participate. I always try to have a good attitude in church, but I didn't have it in me that day. So I cross my arms. And I just really basically pouted in church because they're singing something I don't like. So, and I thought, well, maybe the worship leader will notice I'm not singing, and maybe afterward he'll ask me, I noticed you weren't singing, what was going on, and I'll say, I'm glad you asked. It's because I can't stand that song. But because I'm not singing, I'm looking around to seeing what other poor victims are doing that don't know better, and they're singing anyway, and I noticed that on the platform are my two boys. My one son plays the drums, playing away in the worship team. My other son plays guitar, playing away in the worship. Both of them just helping God's people worship God with this imperfect song. And I started to feel I feel a little convicted. And so I'm looking around for my daughter. I see her down the row from me. She's just singing away, praising God. I see all three of my teenage kids praising God. And there's Dad pouting with his arms crossed. And at that point, God just said to me, "Richard, do you ever want your kids or your grandkids one day to look over at you in church and see you frowning in the middle of a worship service?" God said, "You came here for me. It's about me." And what God just said to me in that moment was, "Are you telling me that after all that I've done for you, after all the blessings and undeserved grace I've showered upon you, are you telling me all it takes is one song that you don't like, and you just bail out and say, there goes my joy. My joy's gone. They sang a song I don't like. Okay, I'm going to just have my own little sort of private pout here in the middle of the church service." And God reminded me of a guy I met a couple years before that. He was a Chinese pastor in China. He'd actually been arrested, put in prison for being a pastor. And for about 15 years, he was in jail. Most of that was in solitary confinement. And he'd gotten out, and I had lunch with him one day. What do you say to a guy who spent 15 years in solitary confinement for doing the same thing I've done for free in North America? And so I asked him a really dumb question. I mean, this is one of those moments I should have just not said anything, but I felt like I should say something. So I asked him a really dumb question. I said, "So, like, what would you do on a Sunday? You know, you're a pastor in solitary confinement. What would you do on Sunday?" Which I can't believe I asked him that, but he kind of looked at me for a moment. He said, "Well, you know, sometimes you lost track of what day of the week it was, what week of the month it was, because you were just there. It, like, one day floated to the next." But he said, "You know, now and then, if I realized it was a Sunday in particular," he said, "I would just feel like I want to have a special time with the Lord." So he said, "I would just begin thanking God for all that he had done for me." And he said, "It would be like God's presence would just fill that little cell. And before I knew it, he said, it was just, I would just have tears in my eyes, and I would do, the joy of the Lord would just overwhelm me at his presence. And there, those special moments with him, I'll just never forget. And I can see the smile and the joy in his face even as he's recalling it. And God reminded me of that moment as I was pouting in church. He was saying, those people took away his house. They took away his family. They took away his job, his money. They took away his freedom. They gave him a little tiny cell, and he still had the joy of the Lord because they couldn't take God's presence away from him. And there you are, Richard. What, half a song you don't care for, and your joy's gone. That's all it takes. In church? In my presence? But have you ever looked around? See, I'm in a lot of churches, and so I look around at, you know, kind of feel for the people I'm speaking to. And there are a lot of times you think, I think I somehow stumbled into the Holy Church of the Sour Lemons or something. It's like the ushers must feed lemon rinds to everybody as they walk in the door because everybody there looks like they're in pain. I mean, they're singing songs, and you look, especially some of the men, they just don't open their mouth the entire song service. One guy looks so pained. We're singing a song, and other people are just all into it. I look over this one guy. He looks in such discomfort. I want to go and ask him, like, you look like you're passing a kidney stone. Do I need to call 911 for you? Are you going to be okay? Can I get you some water? Like, and he's just, that's what he does every Sunday. Stands there and just is in pain through most of the service. You know, I've known so many people who said, you know, I don't know what happened. Like, I dragged my kids to church every Sunday when they were young. They got old and they left. And it's like, you know what? If I could have shown a video of what was going on those Sundays, there you were out in the car honking your horn because they were going to be late for church. And sure enough, when you got to church, your favorite parking spot was already occupied, which put you in a bad mood. You had to get into church. And then they sang a song you didn't like. And you don't sing anyway, so I guess it doesn't matter. But you don't like listening to other people sing songs that you don't like. And then the pastor preached a sermon. He went a few minutes over time, which irritated you because now you're going to be late for getting to the restaurant. You won't get home in time for when the ball game starts. But you can't figure out why your kids didn't just love going with you to church every Sunday. Why was it as soon as they turned 18, they said, Dad, you know, we're out of here. Like, church isn't for us. Because, you know, kids in kids' generation now, they're smart enough to figure out, if Dad was miserable every week going to church, anyone with any brains would know you don't go somewhere where you're miserable all the time. So why do it? See, when our kids were turning 18, I was really concerned that 70% of kids are walked away from church. So you know what a lot of Christian parents do? They try to figure out, okay, so how do we help our kids in such a way so that that they don't walk away. Like, how do we raise them as teenagers so that they embrace the faith instead of rejecting it? And this is what my wife and I figured out. You can't build enough, you can't surround your kids with enough rules to make them be a Christian when they turn 18. There's not enough curfews you can impose so your kids are afraid to walk away from God. They're going to do it. Rules will never drive kids to church. You know why so many kids leave church? Because you say, well, you grew up in a Christian home. Why did you reject that? Because being in my Christian home just meant you had a whole lot of rules to follow. And you got slammed if you didn't follow them. So what my wife and I decided was, let's make, like, if being in the presence of God is fullness of joy, then being in the home of Christians ought to be a home of joy, should it not? Like, it ought to be a place where there's laughter taking place all the time. It ought to be a blast to be a Christian. So we decided, let's make this home so full of the joy of the Lord that my kids would be stupid to run away from that. See, how you can rebel against a rule. By the way, I was telling, one of the books, the book I wrote with my daughter back there, Customized Parenting, we kind of go into this about how we made our home a lot of fun. But one of the chapters is about, so how many rules should you have in your home? What we found was, if you got a lot of rules in your home, you don't have a lot of character in your kids. Go for character, you don't need a lot of rules. The only reason you need a lot of rules is because you don't trust your kids' character to do what's right. So you surround them with rules. If you build your kids so they're responsible, loving, godly kids, you don't need a lot. We had three rules in our household, that's all we had. And because this, we realize this, if you got a lot of, every rule you have just invites rebellion, doesn't it? If you got 100 rules, you're going to probably have at least 100 rebellions at some point. So if you have a few rules, you don't have a lot to rebel against. So we thought is, let's not lead with rules, let's lead with the joy of the Lord. Let's make being a Christian family so awesome, so much fun. Like, how do you rebel against the joy of the Lord? You know, like what teenager says, I just can't take all this laughter anymore. I'm getting out of here. Like, this is crazy. You know, they don't do that, right? Why do you walk away from things? It's because you don't enjoy it. It's not attractive. So let's just make the Christian life so joyful that you'd be crazy to walk away from it, because you can't think of anything that the world has to offer that's as attractive as just being in a Christian home. So what God, that day in that worship service, what God said to me was, if you as the leader in your home can't enjoy the presence of God in church with God's people, then how on earth do you expect your kids to find your faith attractive? Looking at their dad frowning in church and then saying, oh boy, I can hardly wait to be in church like my dad is. I wanted to be the most joyful guy in the room. I want my kids to see that when dad draws near to the presence of God, dad is just having a great time. And so I can't sing. I mean, I can't hit a note if my life depended upon it. But you know what? That doesn't matter, right? If you're singing for God. So I just had this thing, like, I'm just going to belt it out. I'm not going to be one of those men that stands there and doesn't sing, doesn't open his Bible, just puts in his time and then goes. Like, I'm all in. Like, if this is God, this is not about me. By the way, have you ever walked out of a worship service and said, boy, I just didn't get anything out of that today? Well, you wouldn't do that in this church, but if I've known other churches where people did that, you know, they said, I didn't get anything out of that today. You know, have you ever gotten to the back of the auditorium and turned around, looked at where you were sitting and asked the question, did God get anything out of what I just did in there? It was for him. Did the angels of heaven look over, hey, look at this guy. Wow, does he ever love God? Look at him go. When was the last time people looked at you and said, now there's someone who's in love with Jesus. Look at the way he worships God. Guys, men are not known for that. You know, men are not known for that. Women sometimes get into the service. Men typically don't. It's not cool, you know, whatever, they're awkward singing. But I decided, you know what, it doesn't matter. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to sing away. So I've had people, you know, stare at me. I mean, I've been in churches where people sitting in front of me actually turned around and looked like, what on earth was that hideous noise? Like, I thought there was a Canadian bull moose that wandered into the auditorium, was bellowing for a mate. Oh, no, it's just Richard. He's singing, I suppose. That's what he thinks it is. You know? I was in a church in Greenville, South Carolina, preaching one time. I brought my daughter. She's about 18 at the time. And so I've never been to this church before. We're in the song service. I'm just singing away, you know, and whether I know the song or not, I'm just belting it out. And my daughter keeps looking at me. Like, just keeps looking at me. And I couldn't figure out what. Finally, I'm looking at her like, can I help you? Like, are you okay? I thought maybe she needed to use the bathroom or something. Just didn't know where it was. Or, you know, I said, can I help you? And she looks at me and says, Dad, are you doing that on purpose? I said, doing what? She said, singing off key on every solitary note. She said, I've heard people miss a high note, miss a low note. I've never heard anybody miss every note in the entire song. I didn't know that was humanly possible. I said, Dad, Gary, I'm just singing. She said, Dad, I may be 18, but I know singing when I hear it. And that is not singing. That is not music. And I said, but I want my kids, you know, if you were to interview my kids and say, what was it like? We're going to church and worshiping with your dad. They would say, you didn't want to ever sit too close to him because his singing would throw you off and it would be awful. But you know what? Our dad loved drawing near to God. Because when he drew near to God, there was fullness of joy. You could just see it all over dad's face. He was having a time just getting close to God. That's what it's about. So, but you know, God, why is it that I can be on vacation and lose my joy? Why is it I can be in church of all places and be in a bad mood? It's because I get my eye off of what I should have it on, isn't it? And I let myself drift away from where I should be. Well, one last area, and that's the service of God. Could you serve God and not have the joy of God? I've seen a lot of people, you know. I've seen people that come up to me and, you know, they'll say, I've been on the, you know, the flower committee for 25 years, you know. They're just the most miserable person, you know. No one ever helps. No one ever offers to pitch in. I've been the only one doing it all by myself for 25 years, but I've been, you know, faithful. We think that doing something joylessly for 25 years is the same thing as being faithful. I mean, I've sung in the choir for the last 20 years. No one's seen me in recent memory smile, but I've been there by gum every week, whether I want to be or not. You know, you see people serve. Ushers. I've been in a lot of churches, you know. You're not even sure if they're alive. They're just standing there with a bulletin in their hand. And it's like, I don't want to disturb you. Just give one of those bulletins and keep going. Like, I'm afraid I'll wake you up and you might yell at me or bite me. It's just like, you know, you see these people, they're there every week serving. But there's no joy. There's no joy in what they're doing. They're just trying to be faithful. Which, by the way, folks, if you're doing anything and not reflecting well on Christ, you're not being faithful. You're in a rut is what you are. You're just putting in time. You're working, but you're not serving. You know, to serve the King, you ought to have the joy of the King all over you. And, you know, sometimes we think, well, yeah, but what I'm doing is not that important. You know, I don't get behind the pulpit. I don't do this or that. Hey, any job that the King gives you is a royal assignment. And it's more than you deserve. Just be blown away that God would let you do anything that reflects on Him. What an undeserved privilege to serve the King, to do something in Christ's name. But again, is it possible to be at a church event, helping out, serving, doing a good deed, and actually do it joylessly? Well, it is. And I'm afraid people do it in the church all the time. Faithfully, week after week. And you know, a lot of times I've talked to even kids whose maybe their dad was a deacon or an elder in the church for 20, 30 years. You know, what was it like? Your dad, he was a well-known elder in the church for 30 years. You know, what was your dad like? And sometimes I'm just actually getting mischievous. I shouldn't even be doing this. I know I'm setting up some kids, but it's like, so what was it like growing up in his home? And, you know, they'll say things like, so what was your dad like? And they'll use words like, oh, faithful, you know, devout, committed, hardworking, but they never use the word joyful. There's a lot of kids who would never describe their dad with the word joyful. They'd say Bible-believing, conservative, orthodox, whatever, but they'd never say joyful. And at a certain point, God just convicted me that I want that to be one of the descriptors my kids use of me. Because when you're joyful, it means that you've been abiding in the presence of Christ. And you just have gotten so close to Christ, you can't wipe the grin off your face because you got the joy of the Lord. But see, I've served God joylessly. Faithfully, consistently, on time, dependably, but joylessly. I've preached joylessly. I've led committee meetings joylessly. I've served in all kinds of capacities without joy. I remember when I left being a pastor of a church, I moved to be the president of the seminary. And when I first moved to this new city, nobody really knew me there yet, so I didn't have anywhere to preach. And I had really enjoyed preaching in my church every week. And so I went for several weeks, and I hadn't preached a sermon. And so I've got all these sermons. If you preach, you sort of know, like, you get these sermons welling up within you. But my children were not volunteering to let me use them on them. And so I've got all these sermons that need release. You know, I need a congregation somewhere to preach to. And so one day we joined a church in town. And so the pastor of that church, he called me on a Thursday morning. And he said, hey, Richard, listen, are you going to be in town tonight? I said, yeah. And he said, well, great. He said, because, listen, I wonder if you can help me out. He said, because typically on this Thursday each month, I go to a retirement home, and I conduct a little service for all the senior citizens in the home. But he said, I've been called out of town. I was just hoping that you could fill in for me. He said, you can preach whatever you want, about a 30-minute sermon. They have a few songs. Anything will be fine. And so I thought, yeah, I could do that. Now, what I didn't tell him was that, you know, I was itching to preach somewhere, and this would be great. I thought, boy, I would not just preach a sermon for these guys. I mean, I'm a seminary president. I've got a PhD. I will give them the mother of all sermons. I mean, these elderly folks, I mean, some of them probably are wondering about, like, the life to come and the pearly gates and on the judgment. And so I thought, how could I weave in one sermon and just kind of answer all the questions that a senior adult might have? And I thought I'd even do a Greek study on the word for retirement, you know, and just like weave that into the sermon. And so I'm pulling out commentaries and trying to work on this sermon and focusing in. I've got my task before me to get done. And so my wife calls to check in later, and I said, oh, by the way, Lisa, tonight after dinner, I'm going to have to slip out. I've got to go minister at the retirement home. I'll be preaching there. And my, like I told you, my wife's always looking for a party. And so she goes, oh, really? She said, we know the kids and I, like, we haven't heard you preach for a while. And maybe we should go with you. It would be fun. I said, no, Lisa, don't even go there. Don't even start with that idea. I said, because I'm not going to be having fun. I am going to be serving God. She's like, I didn't know those were mutually exclusive. She said, I said, no, because Lisa, I know you. Like, you're always looking for a good time. And I'll be there ministering to all these people and answering their questions and counseling and praying with them. And I said, I can't have you coming up and pulling on my shirt sleeve and telling me that you're bored and you want to go home. Because I said, it's a policy with me. I just don't leave the building until I've spoken to every person who wants to talk to me. I can be there for hours ministering to those people. And my wife just dug in her heels. She's like, well, we'll bring books. We'll just read while you're ministering to the multitudes. And so, I know I'm not going to win. So I just said, all right, but just stay out of my way because I'm a professional. I'm going to be working tonight. So we get there and I'm preaching away. And I've never had a service like this before where in the entire room, not one person was looking at me. Everybody's looking this way to this wall. I thought I'd stumbled into a room with people with neck conditions or something. Like, they're all just stuck that way. So I'm like, what are these people looking at? Like, I've got a riveting sermon going on here, and they're not even paying attention. So I look where they're looking. Of course, they spied my kids. Like, at that time, they're like 8 and 6 and 2 or so. And my wife has, you know, spruced them all up, cleaned them up, combed their hairs, dressed my daughter up in this frilly little dress that my mother made for her. But she's sitting them all over against the wall, out of the sight line so that they won't disturb anything. But of course, the seniors have all spied them. There's a woman sitting right next to my daughter. She's reaching over and touching the lace on her dress. There's a couple of older men a few rows back. They're having a gunfight with my two boys. They're like shooting at my sons. And there's a kind of a large woman sitting in front of them. They're ducking behind this woman and shooting. But my kids have, they're 8 and 6. Like, they don't know what to do. They've never been shot at a church before. So they're returning fire. You know, they're shooting. Like, what else can we do? Let's shoot back. You know, there's a woman blowing kisses across the building at my kids. Like, no one is paying attention to me. I got so miffed at that I actually brought my sermon to an abrupt close. I didn't even give them my Greek word. It was like, all right, there'll be no Greek for you tonight. You weren't paying attention. And I just kind of closed the service and prayer, and I turned and I said, all right, by the way, as we're dismissed, I'll be available if anyone would like counseling. And I said, you might have noticed my kids over here, and if you'd like to visit with them, they're over here. There was a stampede. All these people are just swarming my family. They're like 8 people thick. There's a row upon row. Like, everybody's down there talking to my kids. They're telling my kids jokes. They're giving my kids candies. They're asking my wife about the kids in the school and, you know, just wanted to talk to them and touch them and just be involved with them. Not one person spoke to me. Like, I'm just like, am I invisible? Like, no one seems to see me here. You know? Like, nobody talks to me. They're all over there. So I thought, I guess my job is done. I guess my work is finished here. I suppose even in that abbreviated sermon, I must have addressed all the questions these folks have. I suppose I can go home now. But I can't even get to my family. They're just surrounded. So I'm trying to get past all the people, get to my wife. So, excuse me, sir, can I get through here? Ma'am, excuse me, I'm trying to get into my wife. I finally get up to her. I said, Lisa, I'm ready to go home now. And she looks out at all the people waiting in line to talk to them, and she says, well, Richard, it's just a policy with me and the kids. We don't go home until we've talked to everybody that wants to talk to us. And then she looked at me. I thought she kind of looked kind of smug. And she said, you should have brought a book. So I'm just standing there while my family is, you know, talking to all their peeps. And then I see something that just blows me away. There's this very feeble-looking woman. She's got this push cart with, like, handles like this, a basket for a purse or whatever, and she's pushing it down this very long hallway. I mean, it's very slowly pushing it, which would be fine. I suppose she's going to her room, but inside her basket is my 8-year-old son, Mike. And I can just see this woman having a hernia pushing my 8-year-old down the hallway. I couldn't believe it. I said, Mike, what on earth are you doing in that poor woman's basket? get out of there. We're going to get in trouble from the nursing staff. And the woman turns and says, oh, that's all right. She said, I told him to get in. She said, I'm giving him a ride, she said. She's like, tell me if I'm going too fast for you now. It's like, my son's waving, like, Dad, don't leave me. Don't go anywhere. Stay right there. And he gets to the end of the hallway. I yell, all right, Mike, get out of the basket. Say thank you to that nice lady. The woman says, that's all right, she said. I'll bring him back, she said. By the time she gets turned around and she makes it back, everybody else has left the room. And so I grab Mike out of the basket. I said, say thank you to that nice lady. I said, you really shouldn't have done that. But you probably need to get going now, because I knew it would take her the rest of the night to get back down the hallway. She said, well, I've got to give a ride to your other two children. She said, it would only be fair. And so my six-year-old son, Daniel, climbs into the basket. Off he goes, like, Dad, don't go very far away. Don't let him turn the lights out, Dad. By the time my daughter comes back, the nursing staff is making announcements. Anybody visiting the hospital should have left an hour ago. And so we're hurriedly making our way out to the car, and we're pulling out of that parking lot. My son Mike, the oldest, speaks up. He says, Dad, why did those people do that? They're just blowing. They don't know what happened in there. And I'm trying to think how to answer that. I finally said, you know, son, tonight I think God saw a bunch of people desperate for joy. And God looked around to find somebody that could give it to him. And he found you. And I realized in that night, if they'd wanted a sermon, I was their man. If they wanted ministry, I suppose I was their man. But if they were looking for joy, I wasn't the guy to go to. That's not what I had with me. And those folks figured that out right away. They figured out where the joy was. They made a beeline for that. And I said, kids, I pray that all your life, the joy of the Lord so fills your heart that everywhere you go, the joy level just goes up. When you walk into your home and your parents, I pray the joy just goes up. When you walk into the lunchroom, when you walk down the street in your neighborhood, when you walk into church on Sunday, I just pray wherever you go, people just are so glad to see you walk in the room because they know wherever you go, there's joy that comes with you. I said, and that's a choice you guys are going to make. I just pray you never, I remember saying it, just pray you never grow up to be like me and lose your joy somewhere on that journey. Just hold on to it. Keep it even when you're an old guy like me. Because life's too short to squander it living it joylessly. Even one day. You imagine what potential do you have one day, Almighty God walking with you? How much joy could there be? It could be amazing. But how many days have you chosen just to let it go ahead and be a joyless one? Or a joyless week, a joyless month? I'll tell you, I get around a lot of other men, and they'll tell me, you know what, that's me. I provide for my family. I fix stuff that's broken around the house. I get them to church every Sunday. But none of my kids would describe me as a joyful person. I don't know that my wife would describe me that way. And, you know, she deserves to have a joyful home. She deserves to have a joyful home. The joy in your home isn't all up to you, but I tell you what, you ought to be building it up, not being the one tearing it down. You know what, that's every time that I go home. You know, a lot of times by the time I get home, I've had a missed connection, I've had a delayed flight, had lost luggage. I've got a whole bunch of reasons why I shouldn't be joyful when I walk in the door. And then I remember God and what He's done for me, who He is, who He's walking with me. And I think lost luggage, a delayed flight, and God. Who ought to be trumping who? But you know what? In that moment, I just made a silly choice to surrender my joy. And it cost my family. It cost me because I did. So I want to pray with you and just challenge you tonight. You know what would be awesome is when you go home tomorrow, that when you walked in the door, whether it's your wife or you got kids, whoever it is, that... I pray that when you walk in the door, the joy level goes up, and people are glad to see you walk in the door. And I pray, if you're like me, a lot of guys just say, you know what, I would do fun stuff, I just can never think of anything, you know? I'm just not a creative guy. Like, I'm just a hardworking guy, whatever, or just provide for my family. You know what? Don't be satisfied with that. There are ways to have a joyful home. Our book, I think we spent two chapters just talking about stuff we did have to make our home a fun place. Just like there's resources out there. There's people to talk to. I remember going to other. I wasn't that creative when it came to fun stuff. I'd see happy homes in our church, and I'd go to the dad and say, "So tell me what you do. Give me some ideas." And I'd copy. You know, I just, if it worked, if it sounded good, we'd do it in our family. I was shameless. Like I was just trying to do anything I could. So that my kids could have a joyful. I don't want them to be the unlucky kids who got stuck with a boring dad who didn't do anything to try to make his home a more joyful place. Just shrug your shoulders. Hey, I'm just not that much fun. You know, I guess that's just me. Well, get fun, you know. Go read a book. Go talk to people. Go to a parenting seminar. Do something. But become the kind of guy that brings joy into your home. There's just too much at stake not to. Life's so precious. Don't waste a day of it joylessly. Let me pray with you. Lord, thank you for being a God of joy. There are world religions who picture their God as a sinister, aloof, distant, judgmental, condemning God. They couldn't even imagine their God having joy or laughter. And yet repeatedly, we find in the Christian God a God of joy, a God who delights in people. The very first miracle that Jesus performed was in enhancing a party, creating wine at a party. God, thank you for being the kind of God who delights when his people have laughter in their home, who have joy in their heart, who come into church with a smile, who leave filled with joy because of the God that they serve. And God, forgive us for ever drifting away from the presence of a God like that. God, I pray that you just forgive us for those days and maybe even years in our life where we just resigned ourselves to joyless living. God, forgive us for what it cost others for us to choose to be joyless. God, would you just take away all of our excuses about why our life is just too hard for us to have the joy of the Lord. And when we go home, when we relate next to our wife, when we relate next to our kids, our grandkids, God, may you just take our joy to another level. May you so fill us with your presence, we can't help but laugh at your goodness to us and your presence in us. Get our eyes off of our problems, get our eyes on you, and help us to have the joy of the Lord that you so much want us to experience. And so, Lord, if some of us just need a fresh ministering to even tonight, Lord, some of us I know come with a burden. Some of us come with a lot of pain. But God, there's no pain on earth that can suppress the joy of the presence of God. And so help us get so close into your presence that even the most painful experience of our life has to flee in the midst of the joy of the Lord. Help us, Lord, even tonight before we go to bed, in the time we have together, Lord, will you just give us the gift of laughter? Put a smile on our face. Help us to know that even though our problems may remain, the God of the universe remains within us. And help us to cling to that. Help us to enjoy you even tonight. And I'd pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.